love laughs.
Joe, she says, something you have to know about my dad. He is obsessed with Fast and Furious movies.
I smile. That's fine, I say. As long as your father acknowledges that Fast Five is the most brilliant one, an affirmation of family values that simultaneously points the finger at our corrupt judicial system, even as it endorses traditional American values like Sunday dinner and loyalty. I'm fucking on tonight, and Ray claps his hands.
Right again, Professor!
Love groans. She prefers little movies. And 40 is drunk now and quoting The Big Chill, as if his knowledge of acclaimed movies will convince Barry Stein that he has something of his own to say. Ray doesn't like his son like this, drunk and trying. He doesn't like it when Barry Stein motions for Milo to move closer and save him from 40, and I bet sometimes Ray wishes he and Dottie never fucked it up and had kids. It's an ugly thing, the inside of a family, the disappointments, the disgust. And I am relieved when Dottie tugs at my arm.
Professor, she says, I still can't get over that you read all those Jonathan Franzen books. I loved the corrections, but I couldn't get through it. Everyone in my movie club was so excited for the corrections to become a film.
Movie club? I ask.
We were a book club, she concedes. But we couldn't get through this one book that had us all stumped. Something about Haiti. I don't know. It was so long and so sad. And Haiti? It's a reach for us, honestly. I wish we were worldlier, but I'm small at heart. Anyhow, now we watch movies. But maybe if we had a guide for which books to pick...
You should ease back in with something more relatable, I say. Maybe Portnoy's Complaint? And I choke on my drink because I didn't even realize Amy was still on my mind, and she is, clearly, or I wouldn't have suggested that fucking book.
Hey, Professor.
40 leans in, only to be interrupted by a waitress who lays a hand on my shoulder. She is sorry to trouble me, but she has an urgent message. I look around for Love, and Love is gone, and the waitress slips me a napkin. Order, Joe Goldberg. Deliver to Suite 79. When? Now. Chapter 19. Life is kind of like one of those Barry Stein movies where everything works out. I take my orders and I find Love's wing and I knock on the door. She is slow to answer and I take in the luxury of it all, the detail, the panels on the walls. Even the abandoned room service trays look like high art. Flutes, cheese knives, truffle fries. The door opens and Love furrows her brow, looking at me blankly.
I'm sorry, she says. I didn't order any room service.
Love, I say. I know you didn't order any food. I got your note, you know, at the table. She cuts me off.
I said I didn't order room service, she objects.
Then she winks, and it's like that. She tries to close the door, and I stop that from happening with my foot. Love is kind. Love is patient, but also, mainly, above all, yes, love is perverted. Miss, I say, as if I've done this a million times, it's a courtesy from the hotel, a token of our gratitude.
This is sort of inconvenient,
she simpers, running a finger along her collarbone.
My butler just drew a bath.
I tell her I wasn't planning on getting wet and that I have strict orders to service her. She opens the door and it's like stepping into the vault of a fucking bank. It just feels like money. The parquet floor, staunch hardwood, hard wood. Love's little silk shorts and her matching teddy and her buttery skin, slightly darker than the creamy walls. The bed is through French doors, and she could have shut those doors, but she didn't, and I look at those sheets, white, crisp, and I look at her, white, crisp, and she shakes her head.
I told you, she says. My butler drew a bath.
She motions for me to follow her into the bathroom, and it's an obnoxiously Spartan design. A sink you could find in a walk-up in Reseda. Unremarkable chipped tiles on the walls, exposed pipes and a dull shower curtain out of a porno movie, pulled aside to reveal the full tub. But it's not full of water. It's yellow. And she giggles.
Don't tell my dad, she says, breaking character. I don't do this all the time.
Is that champagne? I ask.
Veuve Clicquot.
I bite my lip. Why must something always go wrong? I never should have come up here, and I don't want to get into a tub of champagne. She could have said it was fucking André, and I would have been irritated because I do not need a bathtub of money. First she wants to pretend that I'm her servant, and now she wants to rub her money on my cock, literally. She wants me to soak in her wealth. We are young and new to each other, and this is the good time, the new time, and we don't need a tub of money, and she knows that I can't afford to fill a tub with Veuve Clicquot, and I don't need to do that because my dick alone is good enough. She slips out of her shorts, and a proper lady would have taken off her shirt first. She is bare, as I expected she would be. No jungle there. She moves one strap over her shoulder, exposing one of those love tits I've wanted to see. And she lifts that round love tit and licks her tongue against that firm love nipple, and the shirt collapses onto the floor. She steps into the tub and sinks into the money water, and I don't move, and my head explodes with bad love wordplay. Is this love is all you need is love for real?
Come on in, she says. It's so good in here.
But I won't come on in. Of all the fantasies she could have gone with, she had to make me into a servant. She could have opened the door and pretended that I was a CIA operative, or the hotel doctor, or an escaped convict, but in her fantasy, I'm servile, a have-not, and she's a princess. This is not my fantasy, and she is not the boss, and I tell her to get out.
Joe, she says, what's wrong?
Get out of the tub.
This is for us.
Drain the tub, love.
This is $25,000 worth of champagne, she argues. Why don't we just get in?
I step closer. Drain the tub. She doesn't want to drain the tub, and she grinds her teeth.
Why?
I look at her. Because I don't need $25,000 of anything.
I thought it would be fun, she pouts.
She stands, parts of her body obscured by bubbles, and she hits the drain. The money begins to disappear into the sewer system, and I tell her to dry off. I slam the door. Fuck her if she thinks she can buy me. I kick off my shoes and peel away my clothes. I hear her snag one of the many plush towels. She's drying up, fuck you, symbolism. And she's pissy, slamming cabinets and draining the tub, ashamed and lecturing me about waste. Yes, the girl who fills a tub with champagne is gonna teach me about conservation. This is good. She should feel ashamed. That money could have fed a lot of poor kids. And this is my room now, and I am in charge, and she yanks the door open, and she's wrapped in a towel.
What the fuck is wrong with you? She asks. Really, I want to know.
Take off that towel. She looks around as if I'm the kind of asshole who would record something this intimate. I tell her the rules. No talking. She nods. I'm going to recreate what we had in the room at Soho House. We're gonna play Joe Says. She opens her mouth. Joe says no talking. She smiles, complicit. She drops her towel. Joe says hand on pussy. She slaps her right hand over her vagina. Joe says left hand on pussy. She switches hands. Rub your clit. She looks at me. Our eyes are locked, and I step even closer. Kiss me the way you did in the room. Her lips quiver. Feel how wet you are down there. Now feel how hard I am for you. She looks down at me. Push me under the bed and climb on top of me and ride me until you can't take it anymore. Tell me what you want. Exactly what you want, and make me give it to you how you like it. I reach for one of her taut, ripe nipples. Let me start by licking your tits as I feel you up. She spreads her legs, and now we are so close that our eyelashes could touch. Come as hard as you can, because you don't need any fucking champagne when you're fucking me. Show me that you know that. Take me. She huffs. Own me. She puffs. Joe says, fuck me. We are on the bed. I don't even know how we got there. I just know about skin meeting skin. Love is all you need is love. And this sex is a circle. It never ends. We are animals and she is loud. Joe says don't stop. Fuck me. And when I'm not possessed by the pure rapture between her legs, between the sheets, I laugh. Joe has love. I have never known this kind of wetness. The stuff of pornography. Sopping. I want to eat her, but I hold back. I am not a servant. And I nip at her belly and she pulls me on top of her for more. And she is silent, demanding, and she pulls me inside of her, and it's like Chateau, the body version. I belong in here, in love. I want her to taste me. Get your dick sucked. And I tell her, and she turns into a different person. Oh, I kinda don't do that. If there were music, it would stop. Oh. I say. Kind of is the most useless phrase in the English language. Well, I could do it to you. She squirms. I just like it better like this, she says. She kisses me, and her pussy envelops me, quicksand. And it's impossible to argue about blowjobs as she rides me like a donzi on the water. Bump, bump, bump. And it would be perfect, my best performance yet. Were it not for that little voice in the back of my head, a warning, a caution. Get your dick sucked. It's almost as if she heard Mr. Mooney and she knows I need more. She looks at me. There's a Coke in the fridge? She smiles. Will you get it? I bring the glass bottle of Coke to love and she shakes it and sprays it all over my chest and yes, it's on my dick and yes, kind of. Was just foreplay and she is licking the Coca-Cola off my midsection. She's nothing but a tongue, a set of eyes, hands. She's below my belly button and she is stroking my inner thighs and now she has me in her hands. But somehow there is new cold Coke on my legs. She rises and her eyes meet mine. Fuck me, she says. Joe says, suck me, I say. Love says, fuck me. She takes over, and I give it to her, and I know she's never had it like this before, because she tells me she's never had it like this before. We finished together. Bliss. Natural symphonic mastery of sex. I am thirsty, spent. I swallow the last drops of Coke, and we laugh about our sticky bed. Now, I'm thirsty, she says. I think there's some Coke left, I say, on my dick, and I grin. Nah, she says, and my joke goes right over her head. I'm good. She pinches my nipple. Soon she is asleep and I am awake. The sex. The sex. I ate Amy's superfruits, but it was never worth getting her jungle stuck in my teeth. It's just right with love's pure, classic Coca-Cola pussy, and I will block out the critical part of my brain hissing that the Coke was tainted by the champagne. Fuck you, brain. I dig around the room for love's panties. I am a hunter. I want to smell love, taste her. I find them eventually, and they're in the trash. Mixed in with a banana peel, numerous price tags from Neiman Marcus, and a half-full jar of face cream. I move the trash bin across the room so she'll see it when she wakes up. And I fall asleep too. I wake up the next morning to her laughing. What's so funny? I ask.
I see you figured out my little indulgence, she says. I never wear the same panties twice.
I know. You throw them away every day? She kisses me.
But now that I have you, you can keep them all and you can sew them together and make them into a quilt. I'm not sewing your fucking panties, love.
Oh, yes, you are.
Oh, no, I'm not. We kiss. She licks my earlobe.
You want to take a shower? Or you want to fuck?
I want a blowjob, goddammit. Hashtag my day in LA. Hashtag chateau problems. Hashtag can't get my dick sucked. Joe says, let me taste you. She pulls away.
Joe, she says, is this going to be a problem?
There is nothing even remotely resembling a problem in this room, I say. I was just playing around. I can feel a story coming, and I'm right. Love has never been comfortable with anything oral. Her mother claims she never gave Love's father a blowjob, and she told Love that if a man loves you truly, he doesn't need that. Wow, I say. I can't believe you talk about this stuff with your mom.
We don't really have boundaries.
Huh.
What?
Nothing.
Joe?
Don't take this the wrong way, but they met in middle school. Do you really think your dad has gone his whole life without getting his dick sucked? She shakes her head.
That's the part of the story I'm getting to, she says.
And then she tells me about the year she and 40 had their Sweet 16, a giant Beverly Hills bonanza with hundreds of people. She got a horse as her present, and 40 got a massage.
And 40 gets home, Love says, and he is messed up. And I'm like, what's wrong? And he is like, I can't tell you. And I am like, you have to.
And?
And my dad's masseuse sucked his dick. And she told him she did that for my dad once a week.
I'm sorry, but that's fucked up. Love shrugs and says that we can play Joe Says all day long, but she'll never do anything oral with me. Or anyone.
I know you want to know if I did this for Michael or Trey, she says. And the answer is no.
I strategize. I'm just thinking, you know, it's different for everyone, I say. What your mom doesn't like, you know, maybe you would like. Love says that she is 35 years old and she knows exactly who she is. She kisses me and grabs a room service menu. We order eggs Benny and coffee and pancakes, and we both look at mimosa on the menu, but champagne is a sore spot. I tell her I like her. She says she likes me too. We sink into the bed together, and this is what it is. Sex. Then a knock at the door, then food, then rest, then movies, then sex. Then we think about leaving the room and we don't leave the room, then sex. Then sometimes we get in the tub, then movies, then food, then sometimes a song, then sex, then Joe says slash Love says. Love has a butler named Henry and she texts him and he shows up with animal style In-N-Out burgers. We half watch movies on TBS, Love's favorite station, and when Bride Wars begins, she says she never cheated on either of her husbands. I tell her I never cheated on anyone either.
But you were never married, she asks.
No. I don't want to tell her about Beck or Amy. That's what feels so unique about this room, this thing with Love. I've been trying to find Amy for so long, and now to break away from all that hunting, to rest, in this room, in this bed. I rarely think about the mug of piss in Rhode Island. It's as though there are invisible guards outside, like nobody can get us, our DNA, our pasts. It's only been 5 meals, maybe 2 days. I genuinely don't know. Love is a drug. The more she opens up about her life, the less I want to share my own stories with her. My life feels too small, too gritty.
Okay, she says. You'll let me know when you're ready.
Love is patient. She doesn't push. It's actually fun to watch Cocktail with her because unlike Amy, she takes it for what it is. Love likes Hannah and her sisters, but she doesn't love it the way she loves Crimes and Misdemeanors. Just when I think she might be perfect, she claps for the opening credits of Dirty Dancing. She hits the mute button.
Let's not have any sound, she says. I've seen this so many times, I don't need to hear it to watch it.
I blindfold her to see if she can watch it without hearing it or seeing it, and I kiss her all over her body. Underneath her knees, her elbows, her inner thighs. I do not eat her out. I make her come without touching her vagina. She says that's a first. Does this place have a pool? I ask. It does, and Mr. Mooney was wrong. The pool is not cold and dirty. The pool is a giant blue oval, as welcoming as Love's vagina. My phone falls inside of it, and Love swan dives to the bottom and emerges with it in hand. Her butler puts it in rice. I'm tempted to ask him to throw it away. Love says my broken phone is a sign that I'm supposed to relax. And maybe I am, because it's hard to care about my life before love. This is why people go west, smashing rocks and hoping to spot something shimmering in the creek. Dip a pan into the rocky water and lift it and strain it, and then feel solid gold in the palm of your hand. Everything I did was worth it because it led me straight into Love's arms. Chapter 20. I can't decide what I like more. This bed, or these sheets, or this view, or the balcony, or the jam and toast that were waiting here when I woke up. Chateau is adult Disney World, the kind of place where they're one step ahead of you. I didn't have to ask for my phone. It was here when I woke up, in the little basket by the bread, by the silver coffee pot, so much more elegant than Keurig. Love's still sleeping, and I put on a robe and pour my coffee and spread jam on my soft blonde bread and walk out to the balcony. I am awkward at first, not used to having toast and a balcony and a robe. I'll have to look in the mirror after I finish my breakfast because I'm curious to see if I look different, if all this luxury closed my pores. Maybe I don't even need to buy Henderson's skincare products. I'm happy, and they could evict us right now, and I wouldn't care as long as they let me take that dirty little minx in the bed. Even the no blowjob bit. I'm a man. It's good to have a goal. I lean on the balcony rail and turn on my phone. When it finally boots up, it proceeds to buzz like it's having a heart attack from trying to keep up with all these texts from Delilah.
Hey, what do you think about tomorrow? My mom says hi, LOL. My mom loves Dan Tana. Seems good, right? Hey. Joe?
ASDJKASDKASDSDA.
Hey, are you okay? Harvey says you never came home. Calling hospitals. My mom is only here till Monday. This is fucked. Going to Birds? Going to Birds. See you there?
ASDBSJKDASKD.
Yes? Knock, knock. La Poubelle? At La Poo. Fuck off! Hey, Joe, are you okay? Look, I know I shouldn't have asked you to meet my mother, but it's not what you think. She's cool. I didn't mean it in a meet-the-parents kind of way, so you don't have to disappear on me.
There's a picture of Delilah's tits. Real. Pert. There's another text.
If you're not dead, I'm never speaking to you again. I don't need this. I have a lot of great things in my life and a lot of reasons to be happy, and I don't need you blowing me off like this. So do me a favor and just leave me alone, okay? Okay.
And now it's Calvin's turn. He wrote to me just 18 minutes ago.
Dude, hot chick in store. She's got a Portnoy's complaint. Book, not screenplay.
I thought I was done. That it was over. But my beating heart and shaking hands tell me it's not. Amy. Finally. I write back. Hold her. On my way. Calvin writes back.
How?
He wants to be a writer, but he can't come up with a fucking plan to make a girl wait 20 minutes. I send my orders. Tell her that your supervisor is in yoga and you have to wait for him to get out so you can get his approval. Calvin writes back.
Cool.
He should have said smart. And with shaking hands, I scribble a note for snoring love. Gotta run. Be back soon. And I nearly fall over trying to get out of the fucking robe and into my clothes. I shut the door and step into the hallway, into reality. I don't have a key, this isn't my suite, and I kick a discarded room service tray. Lazy, unhungry fucks tossing out lukewarm, high-end pancakes, and I don't belong here. I had a purpose and a goal, and I need closure, and fuck! I hail a cab on Sunset. The world is uglier than it was before, and I feel hungover even though I wasn't drunk. Calvin texts. She asked what kind of yoga. I said Hatha, FYI. I write back, I'm close. And I am. This is it. I am queasy and the cab is fast and we are here. Across the street, I see her in the shop flirting with Calvin. Cunt. The crosswalk is flashing red, but fuck it. This is Fast Five and I have my target in the crosshairs. I will risk another jaywalking ticket. I get out of the cab, I run. I make it to the double lines before the driver wails on his horn. You need to pay me! He screams. I forget to pay because I'm so used to Uber and technology is killing our instincts. I look into the shop. Amy and Calvin must have heard the horn because they look up and Amy's eyes widen. The driver wails on the horn again, and now the light is green and more people are honking. Range Rovers want me out of the fucking way, and a woman in a Prius enjoys laying on her horn, taking out all that rejection rage on me. Even if I did run out on this cabbie, which I can't, the mug of piss, I would miss Amy. She's out the door and she's on foot. She's around the corner, into a waiting car, a passenger, not a driver, and she's gone. I don't get hit by a car, but if I did, I don't think it would matter. My nerves are shot. I've gone from the high of love to the adrenaline of Amy to the crash, to forking wrinkled tens out of my wallet to pay this cabbie as he bitches about, you kids and your Ubers, and to know that I was so close. All the nights I spent in this village waiting, that bitch knew. She had to have known. The cabbie goes, disgusted, as if his shitty day compares to mine. I walk east to the corner of Franklin and Bronson and wait for the crosswalk to turn white. I plod across the street and into the bookshop, and Calvin looks like a different person. He's shaved. His hair is short. He's wearing a hashtag I was there t-shirt.
Dude, he says. I did everything I could, but she had to jam. She said she'll be back.
I don't bother telling him how wrong he is. I just slump into a chair behind the counter.
So where have you been? He asks.
I was in West Hollywood, I explain, and I can't believe I missed her.
Did you have a meeting?
He asks, as if that would matter, as if I didn't move here to kill Amy, to find Amy. I tear into one of Calvin's Think Thin bars. Yeah, I say, deflated.
A two-day meeting?
He asks, all hopped up now, as if this might mean he gets to ride along.
Delilah said you haven't been around.
Delilah. And I sigh. Yeah, I say. A friend in town, a meeting, no big deal. Calvin picks up his iPad.
She was filthy hot, he says. The Amy chick?
Yeah, I say, but love is prettier and softer, and Amy has fucked me over again. I groan. Love does not know my phone number, and never seeing her again is possible. I ran out on her, and this is what Amy did to me, and love might think I used her for her body and her bed and her truffle fries. Life is better when it's simpler. If I could just kill Amy, I wouldn't have to worry about her. She wouldn't get in the way of things. If Amy were dead, I would know Love's phone number. Calvin rubs his forefinger on his iPad, the way he always does when he sees a hot girl on Tinder. He smiles.
You can almost see her nips, he says. Wanna see?
I don't want to look at nips, but he pushes the iPad at me, and these nips I do want to see, because they are Amy's nips. How did you get this?
I pretended I was taking a selfie, and I got a picture of her, he says.
And Calvin missed his calling. I could hug him. Did you get anything else?
Don't be pissed,
he says, holding up his hands. Okay, I say slowly.
Well, I tried to tell her that the owner was coming back, he laughs, the Hatha yoga shit, but then I said something about Kundalini and she caught on to my bullshit and she was like, what are you really trying to do here? And I was like, I'm trying to get to know you. And she was hot for me, Joe. I'm sorry, but you know, it was like some classic sitcom shit where the friend tries to get the girl to stay for the friend, but then the girl likes the friend.
My heart beats again. I toss the Think Thin bar in the trash. Did you get her number?
No,
he says.
But I did get her address. I told her I would send her a flyer for this show I'm doing.
You got her address?
Yeah,
he says. I reach for his iPad and he pulls back.
And this show, it's called Back in the Day, and we're totally analoging it, you know? We're gonna, like, not promote on Facebook or Twitter or...
Calvin, I barge in, what's her address? He squirms.
Can I say something?
Fucking A. Sure.
I kinda can't.
Why the fuck not? I snap.
It's property of my improv group, and technically, she gave it to the group.
I take a deep breath. I will not lose my mind. That's cool, I say. But you know I won't tell her how I got it.
Yeah,
he says. He smoked an ounce of weed today. Fucker.
But like, I'll know that I gave it to you, and I'll feel shitty about that.
Calvin, who Tinder bangs one girl after another. Calvin, who won't look Delilah in the eye when he runs into her at Birds. Calvin, who won't watch Enlightened because he just can't get into a series with so much chick voiceover. This guy is now gonna talk to me about boundaries? Keep me away from Amy fucking Adam? God, she's a manipulative beast. But I'm better. I hop off my chair. Smoothie? I offer.
Always, he says. Kale.
I go next door and order the kale smoothie, and I go into the bathroom and crush three more of Dez's Percocets. 20 minutes later, Calvin passes out. At last. I reach into his pocket for the password cheat sheet he keeps in his wallet, and I get into his iPad and into the database for his improv group, and boom. The building is around the corner on Bronson, and Amy did settle into this neighborhood. Maybe she got a wealth hangover, and maybe she's still the girl who tells the guy she's using that she misses her own bed, and maybe she's back in it right now, freaking out about seeing me, eating frozen chicken and waiting for the truffle oil to evacuate her pores and ooze out of her body. I go to the pantry and buy violets, the painted ones. Then I go to Bronson and buzz apartment 326. Nothing. I buzz apartment 323. Nothing. I buzz 101, and 101 is female, and 101 is awake.
Hello?
She says, husky. Flowers, I say. The girl in 101 doesn't ask who they're for because everyone likes to get flowers. Woody Allen knows this. Angelica Houston gets murdered in Crimes and Misdemeanors because she wants flowers and lets a stranger into the building. My breath quickens when I enter the lobby and I have to dart into the stairwell because apartment 101 is just a few feet from the front door. In the stairwell, I freeze. I am shaking. The flowers rattle, swish, swish. I don't have to do this. So Amy is harassing me. So what? I could just slip out of this building and run back to love. I prefer love. She's sweeter. She knows music and she's ready for me. So what am I doing in this stairwell, jeopardizing my future with love? Fucking closure, I mutter. If only eternal sunshine of the spotless mind were a real thing, and it's such an asshole Angelino thought to have, unoriginal and bratty. I can't erase my memories of Amy, but I can't stop her from fucking around with my future. I begin my ascent toward her apartment. This stairwell is concrete and white, and every time I step, it echoes. Everyone in this building is sleeping. Angelinos need beauty sleep. They need energy to make storyboards for web series, and hike and talk about movies they'll never make and walk their dogs that hate them. My heart pounds, and I reach the third floor, and I turn the doorknob, and it squeaks, and I flinch, and I bet nobody was ever murdered here before. I jimmy the lock of 326. Nothing is built well anymore, and the front door opens directly into the living room, which is awash in bras, bowls of cereal, empty bottles of Corona Light, and Us Weeklies. There is one sofa, covered in frayed blankets, and a small TV. To the left is a galley kitchen with a sad little countertop meant to facilitate socializing. The TV is off and the apartment is quiet, but there's an open box of Cocoa Krispies on the counter, like someone just made a bowl of cereal and wandered away. I pass the counter and walk past the Pier 1 bar stools into a narrow hallway. The walls are white and there is a bathroom at the end of the hall and the door is open. A closet door to my left is ajar, which means that the door to my right leads to the bedroom. Amy's bedroom. This is it. I put my hand on the doorknob and push. The room is small and dark. Marilyn Monroe hovers above the bed, a breathy beacon in white, immortalized on the wall.
Why, hello, Joe.
Beneath her is a rumpled comforter covering the faint outline of a body. Hair peeks out from those covers, blonde, greasy. My breath is short. I count down. I flex. I clench my jaw, and in one fell swoop, I peel away the blanket. There's a shriek and a kick, and a little ninja, a foot shorter than Amy, in a black tank and black panties, springs up as I fall onto my back. The floor is hard. Wood. Her foot is a weapon, and she knows it. She kicks me in the crotch. I scream and roll to my side, and that foot gets my kidney. I fold into myself, and now she gets my tailbone, and I retreat, and now that fucking foot jabs me in the belly. Stop! I beg. She kicks me again, harder. And I deserve this because I didn't find Amy, because I don't know love's number, because my balls have been kicked into my intestines. She jumps on the bed and stands in karate chop mode. She yelps, "Don't move!" As if I could turn over, as if my body isn't a collection of throbbing, busted places. I breathe. This was supposed to be Amy. That was supposed to be me on the bed, in control. I open my eyes. She perceives my eyes as a threat, and she jumps off the bed and kicks me in the head. Everything goes away now. The pain, and the fear, and the anger, and the lukewarm blood. Blackout. Chapter 21.
Don't move!
The girl says again. I can't move. She's being redundant. While I was out cold, she went to work on me. She tied my limbs together with resistance bands. I'm a mermaid flat on her white shag area rug. I can't talk. A resistance band is wrapped around my head, cutting through my mouth and jamming my tongue. The girl paces. She grips her cell phone, and I wonder when she called the cops. What's taking so long? How bad is this gonna get? Fuck these fucking resistance bands, and I have only one move. I cry. In the big way. For everything bad, the starving kids and the way Harvey refreshes his YouTube videos. For Calvin's body, how confusing it must be, the pot and the coke, the acting and the writing. I cry for Mr. Mooney and his eggs, and for Marilyn Monroe, framed here too. She is everywhere, and yet she is dead. My captor picks up a pair of scissors and kneels beside me. Ferberizing a baby is no easy thing. She pulls the band from my cheek and cuts it.
Enough!
She screams. I blubber. I work my lower lip. I drool.
My God, thank you.
She grabs a hand towel and wipes my face.
Stop it.
I'm
sorry.
I stammer.
I won't move, I promise. I know the cops are coming.
Her eyes flash to the left, and she did not call the cops. She grunts, throws the hand towel on the floor, and she is still holding her scissors and her phone.
I said, stop it.
I nod.
Sorry.
She paces, and there is a reason she did not call the cops. Anyone would call the cops. That mysterious reason is all I have. And I wish I knew what it was, because if it goes away, I'm fucked.
Sometimes they're slow, I assure her. But they'll be here.
She stops moving.
I said, stop it.
I'm sorry.
Stop talking.
I will, I say.
There's just something I want you to know before they get here.
She groans. She looks at me. I blurt,
I was looking for my girlfriend. You broke in. No,
I say,
the door was open. No, it wasn't. Go look,
I plead.
I swear to you, the door was open, just like Lydia said it would be.
The girl storms across the rooms. Her thighs are hard, shiny. She opens the door. She examines the knob. She slams it. I do know how to pick a fucking lock. She returns to me.
Well, who the hell is Lydia?
Do the cops have your code? I ask. I am hashtag team girl.
You should call 911 and make sure they know the access code. They have it,
she lies. She grimaces. She gets a text and she reads and types, and it's probably her best friend, who is like, call the cops. And this girl is like, I got this. And the friend is worried, like, you need to call the cops, sweetie. This is cray. I can smell the dynamics, and I know I have a shot at freedom. This girl doesn't want to bring in male authority figures. Look how many resistance bands she has in her possession. She was training for something like this. This girl is a vigilante, like the renegade hotel manager in Red Eye. I can't make sense of the Marilyn Monroe pictures and the West Elm furniture. They don't match up with her rock-hard thighs, her resistance. But I do know that she would rather have me tied up in her possession than in a holding cell in a part of town she doesn't like. She could have rolled my unconscious body out the door and onto the street. She could have done a lot of things, but she knew how to beat me without breaking me. She tosses her phone onto the sofa.
Is everything okay?
I ask, subtly instructing her that we are equals with each other's best interest at heart. She doesn't like it, and she comes at me and jams the scissors toward my face, stopping a few inches away.
I'll ask the questions, fucker.
Okay, yes. I say,
you're in charge.
She crouches over me. I wish she would put on some fucking pants.
Who are you?
This matters, what I say to her. I have to be someone she wants to set free. This is the most important question I will ever answer, and I swallow.
I'm Paul,
I begin, my mind whirring.
Okay, Paul. What else?
I swear to you, I am not a sicko. I didn't come here to hurt you.
You didn't bring a weapon,
she concedes. She pulls the scissors back, the tiniest bit. I nod.
I'm a mess right now.
Girls want men to be messy. She takes the scissors away. I sigh. I'm taking a semester off from law school. I want to be a prosecutor.
Uh-huh,
she says.
Is your girlfriend in law school too?
I don't have a girlfriend, I answer. She raises her scissors. I was too quick. I fucked up.
You said you were looking for your girlfriend. You specifically said that. Lydia. I'm sorry, I say. I'm freaking out here.
She purses her lips. She puts down her scissors and picks up her phone.
I should call the cops.
I nod, like a Republican promising to lower taxes before a live national audience.
You should,
I agree. I play hard.
I don't blame you if you do. I would have called the second you knocked me out. I show up in your bedroom. It's a fucking nightmare. I can't believe I went to the wrong place. If I were you, I mean, I would have done the same thing, and I'd call the cops. I mean, this is fucked. I know it.
She doesn't dial 911. She looks at me.
But it's not like they're gonna resolve anything. They'll just throw you in jail and let you out a day later.
True, I say.
But then, when you fuck up like I did, you deserve a night in jail.
She still does not dial 911. I'm becoming human. Becoming Paul. Her allegiance is shifting.
I know I should call, she says. As a citizen?
In a neighboring apartment, Shooting Star by Bad Company comes on, blasting. A moment later, it disappears as suddenly as it started. We both laugh.
Every morning, she says. Alarm clock.
That's one hell of a way to start the day, I say. He lives alone, I presume?
He's a she,
she says. And I've got her now. She's opening up. I can see it happening. Anyway, you're right, she says, and it's an important sentence. I'm going to call 911, she promises, but no, she isn't. This isn't about you or me, she rationalizes. This is just what you have to do in these situations.
Yes, I declare, unafraid. It's the right thing.
She slides the unlock button on her phone. I watch her fingers, unpainted, short nails. She enters the passcode. I listen to the neighbor trudge. She hits the number 9. She hesitates. I go in for the final swoop.
Don't feel bad, I say. Believe me, I know I got myself into this.
She stops pushing numbers.
What is your deal? She asks.
And I win. Now I launch into my elaborate story. I tell her that a few months ago, my girlfriend cheated on me, during my first year of law school, which had been very stressful.
Where do you go to law school? She asks.
And God bless women, curious, mysterious creatures, mutating from one mood to another.
UCLA?
I answer, and now I get to the good part. I tell her I was devastated and depressed, and I went on casual encounters on Craigslist.
That's where I met Lydia, I explain.
And Lydia and I had coffee, and she had this fantasy where she wanted me to show up and surprise her in bed.
Ew, she says.
She sits on her sofa.
Does she live in this building?
She did, I say. Or I got the address wrong, but I would have to look at my phone. She had said that she only locks her door when she's with someone, that I was welcome any time. Anyway, I know it all sounds disgusting, but your door was unlocked, and I thought this was the place. She springs. She can't believe she forgot to lock her door, and she blames herself now. She hits her head with her phone.
I need to get better at living here, she says.
The air changes now. She's all about herself, her own failure to lock the door after this guy left. She isn't afraid of me anymore. She's afraid of what would have happened if someone truly dangerous had shown up here. She tosses her phone on the sofa again and picks up her scissors.
Hold still.
She cuts the resistance bands that bind my arms together, and now we get to know each other. Rachel is a nanny. She was the head of the rape crisis center in college, and she still teaches self-defense to women. I caress my wrists.
That explains your moves.
Rachel works for a rich family, and this apartment belongs to them, which is the reason she didn't call the cops.
They're so paranoid, she says. If I called the cops and the cops called them, I mean, it would be a whole thing.
She puts down her scissors.
They're kooky L.A. zillionaires, she says. You can tell how completely sexist and backward they are by all this Marilyn Monroe shit and all the fluffy rugs. It's what an old man thinks a young woman wants, you know?
Well said. I agree, still her prisoner, her yes man. Are they famous? She says they are, but she winces.
I signed a non-disclosure, she reveals. I can't talk to friends or tabloids or anyone. My mom doesn't even know who I work for.
Wow, I say, that's crazy.
Eh, she says. Hopefully I'll be out of here soon. Anyway, are you going to call the Lydia girl? I don't understand women in Los Angeles. The fearlessness.
I could be anyone. I could have been lying. I am lying. I could be a pervert, one of the rapists she is trained to combat. Why is she smiling at me and coyly asking about my imaginary Craigslist hookup? How did she recover so completely to the point of flirting? No, I say. I rub my wrists. I think this is a sign that I should lay low.
Right, she says. You'll get out there when the time is right. I went to this amazing seminar in solitary expansion last month. Life-changing stuff.
She is such an alum. She graduated 10 minutes ago and thinks everything can be solved by rallies and communication and banners and hope. She beams.
Coffee?
I don't want her to call the cops, so I say that I want coffee. She directs me to sit on the sofa while she pours coffee grinds into an old-fashioned coffee maker. She starts talking about herself. In addition to being a nanny and a self-defense instructor, she is an SAT tutor, and she doesn't understand rape fantasies.
I did women's studies at UCLA, she says. So many of the women who study that shit are crazy into rape fantasies. Explain it to me while I freshen up.
She walks past me into her bedroom, and she does not close the door all the way. I can see her as she moves around her room, trying on Victoria's Secret pink sweatpants and kicking them off and slipping into jeans and getting out of those too. And here I sit, waxing fake intellectual about rape fantasies and control issues in Craigslist. Nanny Rachel emerges in a tiny black cotton skirt and big fat UGG boots and a tiny gray half t-shirt. She's wearing lip gloss, lots of it. She brushed her hair. She sprayed perfume. She got dressed up for me. I broke into her home and found her in bed, and she got dressed up for me.
Well, I see what you mean about the thrill of giving up control, but I feel like I give up enough control every time I walk out of my apartment. In the bedroom, I want to be in charge. But I guess you figured that out.
She pours coffee into chipped IKEA mugs that scream LOVE in all caps. Life is cruel, and the word love shouldn't be plastered all over the fucking place. She smells like cigars.
You look like a black coffee guy.
I nod, even though I want cream. Thanks. She looks out her window at the middle parts of the palm trees.
I do love this place, though. And the baby is easy. He doesn't know he's an asshole yet.
She sighs.
But the commute is awful. The family's in Brentwood and Malibu, and I was commuting from Eagle Rock, so the dad was like, why don't you stay here? You know how it is here, the way people are either broke on unemployment or giving out free apartments.
Cool, I say, and I need to know if Amy lives here or if she pulled this address out of a hat. So, do you have a roommate?
Not since I was in college, she says.
Amy picked this address randomly, and because of that bitch, I came here, got beaten, tied up, and forced to drink bitter coffee out of a cracked love mug. I tell Nanny Rachel I have to go. I don't agree that we should exchange numbers. She looks crestfallen.
Good luck with school,
she says. Thanks, I respond. Good luck with the rich folks. She laughs.
Thanks, Paul.
I cross Franklin. I fucked up my chance at a brand new life with love, and I take the long way around to avoid Calvin, and I reach my building and Harvey's not in the office. So there is a God. But Delilah is standing at my door, and her arms are crossed, and her eyes are narrowed, and then she says it.
I know about your problem, Joe.
So maybe there isn't. Chapter 22. This is not my lucky day. Delilah is pacing in my apartment. When I stood her up, I pissed her off, and unfortunately, she didn't dive into a quart of Ben & Jerry's. Instead, she went on a research mission. She's been obsessing about that night I stood her up. She won't say what she knows, but she is building a case against me.
Explain that, she snaps. We had plans.
I know, I say, placating. It was Calvin.
You're a grown-up, she snaps. You're not 10. Don't talk to me about fucking Calvin.
You asked me what happened. I will my forehead to stop sweating.
Your answer can't be Calvin, she says. You have to take responsibility for your actions, Joe. Your actions have consequences, and you ditched me, and that was wrong.
I know it was.
Do you?
She asks, and here we go again. She's downloaded some app that will stop her from texting me in the future, but never mind about the app because I'm the one who led her on and she thinks there's something up with me. There is nothing, I protest. I flaked.
You haven't lived here long enough to use that excuse, she says. You're supposed to be a New York guy.
Delilah, I plead, can you please let this go? But she can't. She has more to tell me. She knows that I told a bartender at Bird's that I knocked up a girl. I did, but I didn't. It's complicated.
That's bullshit, she barks.
Delilah, I say, can we not do this now?
Why?
She asks. Do you have somewhere to be? Is it time for you to go freaking wander around the pantry like a zombie? I don't wander around like a zombie.
Ask Calvin, she says. He'll tell you otherwise.
You just said to leave Calvin out of this, I remind her.
Don't change the subject.
She comes back at me, arms crossed. She says she found out from Calvin that I was at Henderson's and that it was my idea to go to the party.
I know you were there. I have proof.
She shows me a video on YouTube, and there I am in Henderson's fucking kitchen. I want to erase the internet.
Calvin said one minute you were there, and the next minute you were gone. So where did you go, Joe?
I forgot how small this apartment is, how thin the walls. She's trying to put me in a cage, and I won't let her. Delilah, this is not cool.
No, she says. It isn't cool to let me suck your dick and then turn around and shit all over me. That is not cool, and I wanted you to man up and explain to me why you haven't been to work in several days and why you were at Henderson's party when you told me how much you hate him, but if you won't do it, if you won't just tell me.
She trails off and takes a deep breath. She sits. She points at the floor. I sit. What? I ask. She rubs her hands together. She repositions Indian style. She's enjoying this. She wants this, whatever the fuck this is.
Look, she says. I know.
I don't say anything.
I know.
She says it again, and I don't like it. I know. She knows I don't like this, and she reads me well. She really is an investigative fucking reporter, and her hand goes on her chin, and her chin lowers, and I wish she would disappear into thin air. Poof. And depending on what she says next, I might have to make that happen. She breathes in.
I know about your pill problem.
Are you fucking kidding me right now? I exhale and unclench my fists, and she has no idea she saved her own life just now. She sits by me and links her arm through mine and begins to act out some sort of rehab rush fantasy where she can save me from my addiction. She strokes my back and talks to me about promises and halfway houses and the craziness of LA.
Des told me how many Percocets you've been buying, she says. And the way you disappear and wander, I mean, I put two and two together.
She blames the apartment. Brit fell apart too in here. She stares at the Kandinsky.
We can get you better, she says. We can. You just have to want it.
I need her to think she's right, and I tell her I want to do this on my own. I think I need some time, I confess. Ha. She pats my leg, all business.
Do you have insurance?
I tell her that I do, and she says she has an idea, and she leaves and returns 5 minutes later with a fucking board game.
Chutes and ladders, she says. Sometimes you just need to, like, be a kid again, you know?
I don't know, but I push the spinner and feign interest in her tedious anecdotes about celebrities and about the time that George Clooney sort of flirted with her. She swishes down another chute, and the game is never ending, and this is what you deserve when you fuck don't fuck Delilah. I should have known it would come to this, but I was a fool. She wanted me to meet her mom, and I should have gone and placated her. But stupid me, I thought I could fuck Delilah. I thought I understood her in a way that other morons in this building don't. But there was nothing to fear because she's incapable of loving someone like me. She's a star fucker and a gold digger, and while she claims to put on her band-aid dresses in the name of work, in the name of gossip, she is putting on these dresses because Nicolas Cage married a waitress, because Matt Damon married one too, because George fucking Clooney promised his dick to a hot lawyer. Even if I had shown up and met her mother and told her I loved her and bought her flowers for no reason, and asked her to move in and started talking rings and babies, even then it would never last. she would continue working and squeezing into dresses and going to Golden Globes parties and trying to spill drinks on people like James Franco. This is how Calista Flockhart got Harrison Ford, and she would leave me for James Franco if she got the chance. But I did not see the whole picture. I was starved from not getting my dick sucked. I was paranoid because of Henderson, and I was lonely, and I didn't see the loophole.